You've been stewing on that for 2 weeks.
I have been stewing on it, and I've been represented as a frickin' pony in the process of doing so. Okay.
Good morning, boys and girls, and welcome to episode 14 of Bad Voltage. We've got a whole heaping, helping ton of cloudy goodness we're going to be talking about today. It is ridiculous. Jono, what's the first cloudy thing we're talking about?
So we're going to be talking about cloud storage. You know, Ubuntu One's going away, as many of you have heard of. So what those people who are using it, are those people who want to sync their stuff elsewhere? Like, what options are available? Well, we've tried a bunch of them. We're going to share our feedback about what we think is the best thing for you to use.
That is super cloudy. And then we're going to interview Christian Schaller. Schaller? Am I getting this right, guys? You guys just corrected me before the show. Schaller. About specifically the new Fedora Next Fedora workstation thing, which you might notice is not cloudy. And then what are we going to talk about, Jeremy?
And then we will continue our seminal work, Breaking Down the Bullshit, in this episode, The Cloud.
Jeremy's bought himself a Game & Watch for the 21st century, along with a million other people who all get together on Kickstarter. So he's got the pebble, and he's going to tell us all about it.
And then, of course, we're going to get into a community review. We're going to talk about the Bad Voltage survey that we had, about the Bad Voltage listening party, some discussions on the forum where I was vilified, I think is the best way of describing it. And that's pretty much about it. So I always forget at this point, what are we going to do now? What's next?
And now, Bad Voltage.
There's been recent news that Ubuntu One's file cloud storage system is shutting down. And one of the things I was interested in is your thoughts on not only the fact that had happened, but there are a million different rivals. And an awful lot of the stuff I see at the moment is, which should I pick? What should I go for? What's good? What's bad? People are competing on price. They're competing on features. They're competing on what you can do and what you can't. And so I'm interested in our thoughts from each of us on what you use and to represent one of the particular things in the market.
So, who wants to start? Brian.
You want me?
Yeah, we might as well start with Ubuntu One.
All right, let's start with here. So I was using Ubuntu One because John O'Bacon and Mark Shuttleworth told me to. So what I did is I used...
I hope you don't make all your decisions like that.
I used Ubuntu One for a while, and it was not a bad service. But I think Ubuntu One is a wonderful, wonderful life lesson for us all, in that using such a file sync service that is controlled by a company is quite possibly the worst decision that any man, woman, or child could possibly make in the world. Because you will, no matter how altruistic, wonderful, and well-funded by space people a particular file storage system is, it's going to go away at some point. So I use Ubuntu One, and it's gone the way of the donkey, or whatever the heck it is that saying goes that all the British people use.
Yeah, because, by the way, because you know, like, software that's set up by volunteers never goes.
That's
away,
totally correct. Well, no, here's
and we should fill in two other things here. First of all, it's the way of the dodo. Donkeys are still around.
I don't know. I don't know what you guys.
It wasn't around for donkey's years.
Donkey's years. That's the thing. Whatever. You guys just say donkeys a lot.
And secondly, doesn't your complaint apply to anything provided by any company anywhere for any reason?
Absolutely not. So here's the thing. So I have I have a copy of Word for DOS that still runs. It's a proprietary piece of abandoned software, but you can still run it. Now, Ubuntu One, on the other hand, is a service.
Now,
we're going to go through a bunch of options that people can use without being reliant on a company. And I think those are a much better way to go. Now, Jono, what super option, awesome, not reliant on a company, will certainly never go away option did you pick?
I picked Dropbox. Oh! And to be quite clear, I'm using Dropbox free. I'm not using the paid version. I'm planning on upgrading to the paid version. It's not as cheap as some of the alternatives. Yeah. Like Google's a lot cheaper. I think it works out about $120 a year, if I remember right, which for what it is a little pricey, I think. Well, no, I think it is a little pricey in the scheme of
$10 a month.
I agree with Stuart.
Two coffees.
Yeah.
And that'd be
To store like 100 gigs of backed up storage, that's nothing.
It's not going to break the bank, but there's other cheaper options. Now, we use Dropbox to make this show because what happens is when we, very quick backstory, we record the show, use Google Hangout, everyone records their audio locally. And once we've finished recording the show, all the other guys, I record my audio obviously here where I edit the show, all the other guys put their files, which are WAV files, into Dropbox, and then they all sync to my machine and I edit it together. So I use Dropbox quite a lot, and I use it for backing up my, you know, documents and work and all the rest of it. And it is flawless. It is absolutely flawless. I run it on my Mac where I edit the show. I run it on Ubuntu where it works great. I have a client on my iPad, on my Android phone. Like, it works fantastically. So overall, I'm super happy with the Dropbox experience. I think it's reliable.
I have to say, it's not just that it's flawless. It's a byword for flawlessness in this sphere. I mean, we had to pick something which we could all use, right? And we all use different, we're all using different systems, and some things aren't available on some devices, some things don't always work, some things require complicated setup. When we needed something that we could all work with that wouldn't get in our way, we went, okay, let's use Dropbox.
Right.
But it was I would like to add that I think our use of Dropbox is one of the only sane use cases, right? We're using it for ephemeral storage to share things where security is of absolutely zero importance.
Yes.
Oh, if someone got into our Dropbox, they'd get one of our voices for one show early, which, you know, it's about the definition of inconsequential. People that are backing up like their tax information and stuff via Dropbox, personally, I think are out of their mind.
But that goes back to Brian's point, right? Really, yeah, if you're using a company and they're hosting data, that you kind of have to put your trust in that company. You have to make a judgment call. Like, for me, I have a lot of personal data in Dropbox, and I like Dropbox of a company. I trust them.
Even though
because
they
run by Condi Rice, noted friend to security.
I was going to say, you made a pretty poor decision there. I mean, at least Spider Oak is a similar service that at least pretends to care about security. They have the whole zero knowledge thing. They encrypt it on the client side. Dropbox, they're just like, we store your stuff completely unencrypted. Upload your tax information and social security number.
Done.
Yeah, okay. Right. Well, maybe. I'm not as much of a privacy nutter as some people, so, you know.
But that's not just privacy there. That's just general basic security stuff, I think.
I think that they operate a service that I feel comfortable.
Do you put all of your past tax returns and everything, just put them in a box like on your doorstep or something like that? Just leave it out there so people can come through and rifle through it a little bit? Is that cool?
Don't be ridiculous. I don't do tax returns. My wife does that. She puts them on the doorstep. All right, so Jeremy, right? Smart ass, right? Go on. What are you using?
So the one that I chose, I would like to get out right in front of and say is a completely different service than the things like Dropbox or Ubuntu One or Spider Oak, in that it is not meant for sharing really at all. And it's Tarsnap, and their tagline is "Online backups for truly paranoid." So security is highly baked into the product. And I will also add that the one thing that is awesome about Dropbox that Ak kind of alluded to is that it's a very simple install that just works. Where Tarsnap, they have four pillars of their philosophy, and it's security. And by security, they don't only mean encryption, but there's no passwords anywhere throughout the system. It's all key-based.
Flexibility. Oh, I was going to say, that sounds really insecure if there's no passwords, but right, there were keys. Yeah, okay.
Right,
no passwords, how secure away?
Right, no authentication at all. Just they don't accept passwords as a valid authentication mechanism. And then flexibility, efficiency, and utility. And by utility, they mean that it's priced as a utility. It's a very linear model of price.
Does it work? What does it run on? Just
PDP 11.
no, not like what does it run on?
pretty much any operating system, I believe, although the guy that started it is a free BSD developer, so the Unix-based systems are kind of a focus, but it runs on Mac OS, and it runs on Windows, but you need Cygwin, which I would consider this not an average end-user product because of that.
because it's not
1996. But I use it on servers. To be fair, I don't use this on my desktop much, but I do use it on servers. But part of that, with the flexibility comes a lot of complexity, right? This is not something where you install, double-click, there it is, and then pick a folder and it backs it up. The usage of it is very much kind of like tar. And because of that, you have to set up crons or, you know, there's a lot of manual work in getting it to work. But once you get it to work, I would say it for what it's meant to do, it is really a great solution. There's probably two things that are pretty big caveats, though. There's nearly no way to reliably estimate costs because it does quite a bit of compression, but it also does quite a bit of data deduplication. And there's no real way to estimate what your actual storage is going to be because of that, which for a lot of people might be, especially larger corporations, might be a deal breaker.
But Jeremy, why wouldn't you, in that sense, if it's a bit of a pain to set up or it requires technical knowledge to set up, why wouldn't you just, for example, get a VPS from someone like A2 Hosting, who are kind sponsors of the shows, who provide the hosting for the community forums? Why don't you just get that and just basically have offsite backups?
Well, if I'm going to back up something like the LQ infrastructure, I would like to back it up to something that's more resilient than the actual infrastructure, not less. So I'm not going to back up a SAN that's snapshot.
Why don't you get your whole business, back it up to some Palm Pilot somewhere?
Right.
Exactly. You see, that's the difference between you and me, is that for Ak and I, given our sysadmin experiences, everything is more resilient than anything that we're in charge of.
Fair. And I should note that the back end of TarSnap is just Amazon S3, but it's the redundant version of S3, not the newer, cheaper S3.
Okay. Sounds like a deal.
So you also have to trust Amazon. You do get the source to the client, so you could change that if you'd like.
All right, cool. So
nice
language. Former architect of Ubuntu One.
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the things
why he didn't use it.
It hit. I used it all the time for everything.
That was being facetious.
Even when it didn't sync.
You unfile sync closing down hit me really hard because I honestly hadn't expected it. I didn't really have a plan for when it happened.
It's going to be okay.
So right. I spent... It threw me quite seriously. I had an awful lot of stuff that I had things linked from my website there. I had stuff that I wanted to round trip onto my phone and back. I had all my backups went to there. Stuff that I didn't have room for on my laptop but wanted to store somewhere. But that was all in Ubuntu One. I had scripts which talked to it every day, everything. So
Are you still backing up email from 1862?
I keep backups of things.
Message received.
I grant you that the idea of keeping a backup of things is in itself new to you, but
it's actually useful.
Like, shut up, man! Right, I'm just about to describe how I'm better than you at this. So
you can have this.
One of the things that occurred to me is having now been burned a little bit by. Putting my trust in someone else and having them go away. And your point is absolutely right. That's not a thing which is specific to Ubuntu One or specific to SpiderOak or specific to Dropbox or anything. It's the idea that I'm reliant on someone else to not go away. So I thought, well, I've got a server sitting in my house with terabytes of disk space on it. Why the hell am I not using it? So what that meant, I wanted the Ubuntu One experience of having things, having it be a destination for backups, having it be syncable, being able to get the stuff from my phone, everything like that. So syncing rather than, you know, rsync command lines, but I wanted it to run on my server. Now, one of the alternatives is OwnCloud, which as far as I can tell, someone in 2012 wrote down on the back of a matchbook a definition of what cloud storage is and sent it back in time to 1996. And then the people in 1996 went, that's a good idea, and built something to do it in PHP, knowing nothing about cloud storage, called their own cloud and sent it back to us. I hate it.
Okay, so it's now going to be called Pwned Cloud if it's written in PHP.
There are a bunch of other things which do... things I could, you know, back up to S3, stuff like that. But the thing I looked at was BitTorrent Sync, BT Sync. And that provided roughly what I wanted. It allows you to set up independent nodes, independent machines. My server, my my desktop machine, my laptop, all individual machines. And you just tell each of them about the others. You know, you just go, okay, here's my magic number. Teach the magic number to all of them. And then everything just gets synced in between them. Fantastic.
So this is local, right?
Yes.
You're backing up from your fancy PC to some crappy laptop in the corner.
It's all happening on the LAN, but BitTorrent Sync could happily work over the internet. It coordinates itself through a tracker in the same way that BitTorrent downloading does. So there's nothing stopping you installing BitTorrent Sync and me installing it, and as long as we both type the same magic number in, a folder will be synced in between our two machines. Ta-da! It's all point-to-point rather than... It is awesome in concept. I'll get to that. It worried me slightly that it was closed source and no one really understood how it worked, but I wasn't that bothered about that. What I was bothered about is when I got my new machine and told it, okay, BT sync everything, it just wouldn't sync and you couldn't find out why. So there's an open source alternative called Sync Thing, which Alan Pope pointed me at. And it's still quite early days, so it still involves a bit too much manual setup for real people. But I'm happy with it. And it's really good. The same BitTorrent Sync model. And that's what I use now, Sync Thing. So that's running it yourself rather than relying on someone else to do it for you.
Brilliant. So it sounds like we've covered a pretty decent range of options here. We'd like to know your thoughts on the software that we've used and the services we've used, as well as more suggestions. There's tons of these things out there. So go to community.badvoltage.org and share your thoughts there. Okay, so now on the show we've got Christian Schell, who's actually a long-time friend of certainly Ack and I. Jeremy, Brian, do you know Christian?
I don't know who this crazy man is. No.
No. Okay, good. Well, Christian comes from a long background of worked at Fluendo, worked at Collabra, and been very involved in the GStreamer project, but is now the senior manager for the Emerging Platform Group at Red Hat. He's all about emerging. And that's the team that basically works on desktop and installer and Fedora. Now, Christian, how you doing, man?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. And now you wrote a blog entry recently, which was called Preparing the Ground for the Fedora Workstation, and it's caused a little bit of a discussion in the open source community. Can you summarize that first of all, and then we can get into the topic?
Just shouting at you about it.
Yeah, so the Fedora Workstation is part of a bigger effort. I mean, Fedora has been around for over 10 years now, so we decided it was time to revisit some of the ways Fedora has been built and developed, and sort of try to relaunch Fedora a bit. So there's this project called Fedora Next, which essentially splits Fedora into its traditional setup of being a single distribution into being a more three-tier system, where you have a cloud image and a server, and also then a workstation, which is meant to be the desktop offering. And basically, my involvement, because my team is mostly involved with it on the desktop side, is of course trying to help shepherd the workstation effort forward. And we're sort of trying to take a fresh look at how things have been done in Fedora before, trying to also see what's sort of happening in the rest of the marketplace, I mean, with Ubuntu, with Chrome OS, Android, Mac OS, and so on. So we're basically trying to move away also from maybe some of the old fault lines, maybe that's sort of been a bit in the community, and saying, okay, let's start to just build an integrated thing here that can pull in a lot of different parts. Because, I mean, one thing I mentioned in the blog entry, for instance, is that, you know, the Linux community has for a long time sort of got stuck in these kind of technology debates that I feel are somewhat misguided, right? I mean, it's like...
No, we've never seen that. That's never happened before.
How many people do we know, right, who complains about their iPhone running Objective-C or Android being based on Java? It's sort of like a question that never really comes up. But for some reason, I think the Linux community has a tendency to really dig into those kind of things.
I don't mean to disagree with you or anything, but speaking as someone who's done both iPhone and Android development, we yell all the time about both Objective-C and Java, so it's not a Linux thing. I'm just going to throw that out there. Every geek hates every piece of technology all the time, period. That's just how it works.
It's probably just a bit more visible in the Linux world because everything's out in the open, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's also been very developer-heavy community, right? I mean,
right.
Most Android users or iPhone users, you know, if they see some programming syntax, they probably have no idea what it's meant to do or what it can do for that matter.
Right, right.
And I mean, that's the other thing here, of course, is we, I mean, I think as we've seen, right, is that the most successful Linux platforms over the last few years have in some sense not been Linux platforms in the sense of Android and now Chrome OS. Is that, right. Of course, they're using the Linux kernel and a lot of the building blocks that the Linux community has built, but they're not, you know, a traditional distribution in any way or form.
Right, right.
And I think we want to try to mimic some of that with what we're doing with Fedora, but we're also, I mean, a major focus for us, at least to begin with, is also trying to say, okay, how can we make a great developer workstation here? Because we want to help, you know, bring in more developers into the ecosystem, but also make sure that, you know, when people develop the next generation of web services or iPhone apps or whatever, or games for that matter, they do that on the Linux system as opposed to on the Mac OS or Windows.
So, Christian, related to this, I think the first and most important question I have is Fedora, and this is a credit to Fedora, has always had a very, very strong philosophy of we will ship upstream as it was intended to be shipped, right? So GNOME do a bunch of development work, and Fedora will ship it, and there'll be some minimal customizations and adjustments to that wallpapers, choice of fonts, things like that. But broadly, the editorial direction of Fedora traditionally has been very much defined by upstreams. But what you're saying here is it sounds like Fedora having much more control over its own destiny. And we've been through this with Ubuntu. We've been through exactly the same experience. And I'll tell you, it was a bit of a roller coaster getting there.
No, really? Seriously? A little bit of a roller coaster? You guys aren't having problems with that still? All the time? Every single day?
Right. So, I mean, do you feel like that this is, I mean, you know, stepping outside of the philosophy, but just practically, do you think this is even doable within that? We didn't make as much of a firm commitment to upstream, like delivering upstream as in such a vanilla form with Ubuntu. Do you feel like that's even possible with Fedora?
I do think so. I mean, I guess the advantage we have at Red Hat, right, is that we are a quite, well, sizable company at this point in time. And we have developers working on a very wide range of projects, you know, going from kernel and up. So our goal here is not to start carrying a lot of patches, of course, in Fedora. But our goal is that when we set our the development priorities of the teams inside Red Hat, for instance, but also, of course, the Fedora community contributors, it's going to be set in terms of, okay, what do we actually want to see happen here in Fedora in terms of our end product, as opposed to being sort of more just individual priorities of each individual component upstream. Right. And of course, I'm sure there will be cases where the changes we do are not necessarily interesting for upstream. So, A, there might be, of course, that we will end up packaging a few glue code kind of modules that contains maybe some modifications or extensions to the GNOME shell or things like that. Or for that matter, that we get acceptance upstream for adding like a configure flag for having a special option.
Right.
I mean, a good example here, right, is the software installer. Which is the one that Richard Hughes has been developing for GNOME. We want to do things there, like there is going to be an option there, for instance, to install, for instance, KDE through that software installer, at least as our current plans stand. And, of course, that's a feature that is interesting and important from a Fedora perspective, but, of course, from an upstream GNOME perspective, that's not a very useful feature.
Hang on. I understand how it's useful from a large-scale Fedora, which does everything perspective, but from a Fedora workstation perspective, how is it reasonable to say, okay, we're going to define a good, consistent desktop environment, a desktop operating system, and then one of the things you could install is some other different operating system?
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from there, and I think it's different ways of dealing with I guess, over the ecosystem that's out there today. I mean, in the Ubuntu world, right, it's sort of been sorted out by having Kubuntu and Subuntu and Edubuntu and all this alternative. Right. And of course, in terms of workstation, I mean, I think if you read the product description we've put up and tech description, it's very clear that, of course, we have chosen a GNOME shell as our operating system and setup.
Right.
But the reality is we have an existing community where there are many, for instance, KDE users, and we need some way for them to get a system up and running. So, of course...
No, wait. You are profoundly wrong about that. Now, I'm a big fan... of Linux distributions providing choice. Choice is awesome and is excellent. I love being able to load whatever distro or desktop environment I want. However, if your stated purpose is to provide, and let me read this here. I don't even have it right here. I had a quote I was going to read for you. But if your stated purpose is to provide a consistent and quality user experience, why are you even worrying about providing support for other desktop environments? I mean, if it seems like that's just distracting you from your primary goal.
I mean, to add to that, what you're saying sounds a bit like you want to be able to say we're going to define a consistent experience, but you'll piss a load of people off who say, no, but I want to be able to run XFCE on top of Ubuntu, and you're not prepared to say, well, then... Oh, sorry, not on top of Ubuntu, on top of Fedora, ha. And you're not prepared to say, no, Fedora Workstation is not for you. Now, Ubuntu has walked through that fire, but it feels to me like that's going to be... the hardest choice Fedora Workstation has to make. Be prepared to say Fedora Workstation is not for you to some people. Are you prepared to say that?
Or
is it going to try and be all things to all people and at the same time be wonderfully consistent? At which point you're just Slackware in 1986.
No, okay.
Oh, that would be awesome, actually.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, if, as I said, look at the description of what we're doing, right? This is going to be a single install, and you get the GNOME desktop. It's going to be a default thing that you can't take away. And of course, but the fact is, there is people out there. I mean, you can say, yes, there is a community who wants this and are maintaining this and working on this. And the fact that that necessarily isn't the focus of the workstation doesn't mean that these people don't want something. And of course, we could have said, okay, you know, let these people do Kedora instead, right? So that could be the
right
option. But you said, okay, you know, is there an alternative way of doing this? So, of course, if you look at all we're doing, we're trying desperately here to build a very clear and concise integrated experience. But, of course, if you sometimes want to break that experience and install something else, we're not going to, you know, delete those RPMs from the upstream repository and say, sorry, that's not going to be possible. But it's,
why not? Why not?
Well, I think it's part of, you know, accepting where you're coming from, right? That you have an existing user base that you want to provide something for. And I, as long as we don't feel that that's going to, you know, break what we're trying to do with the core product here,
in terms of
our own focus and the group's focus, then I don't see that as a problem.
Yeah, that's fair. And realistically, if you're focusing this at software developers do not like being put in a box. They want to be able to do whatever they want with their system. So that does make a certain amount of sense. The one thing that I was wondering, and looking at the specific mission statement, which is, and I quote, the system will be primarily aimed at providing a platform for development of server-side and client applications that is attractive to a range of developers, which is a really good mission statement. However, that does seem to imply that the existing Fedora installation is really hard for software developers to use or is not meeting the needs of software developers currently. And looking at it, I'm confused as to why that would be the case. I don't know of any software developer that's like, oh, shucks, I just can't figure out how to use Fedora. It's just too gush durned hard. I mean, I guess I'm confused as to what exactly is trying to be accomplished.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not necessarily about how to use Fedora, but it's about how we present the tools available to a developer, for that matter, which tools we encourage for being packaged, or for that matter, which tools we work on improving ourselves. I mean, after we decided to have this focus, right, we for instance, sat down and had a brainstorm about, you know, what features do we want to add to the terminal? Because we know a lot of developers, especially people who are already in Linux space, are heavy terminal users. And we thought, okay, what is lacking today in our default GNOME terminal application? And how can we add new features to make sure that, you know, no developer feels that this terminal doesn't, you know, suit my needs?
Now, are those terminal features going to be Fedora Workstation specific features, or they're going to go back upstream and be available to classic Fedora and SUSE and everyone else that grabs it?
Well, I mean, at the moment, all of them has gone upstream, and I don't. In this case, I don't expect there to be a divergence. I mean, right. Of course, it could be that at some point there is a feature we want that, let's say, upstream says this doesn't really fit what we are trying to do, and thus we will try to figure out a way to deliver that in Fedora specifically, as I said, as some kind of extension or something. But at the moment, especially okay. specific to the terminal, all those features are popping back upstream.
Now, so. I know so we're going a little bit ahead, long here, but I kind of feel like we need to dive into this just a little bit further. Is that, are you cool yeah. with us going a little longer, Giano?
Yeah, totally.
All right. So let's be clear here. Can you give me an example, one clear kind of cut example of what it is that Fedora Workstation would offer someone that is just not doable with existing Fedora? I mean, what is it that Fedora Workstation is really going to be providing? I can't quite picture it in my head.
Well, I mean, there's nothing that in theory you couldn't do on current Fedora, right? It's more about, you know, the tooling we provide. I mean, one project that we're going to, for instance, strongly integrate here is a thing called Software Collections that Red Hat has been working on, which essentially is a system for providing you with a range of, for instance, Python or Perl runtimes. So if you need, for instance, a specific version of Perl currently in Fedora, that's a bit painful. You sort of okay. have the version we're shipping, and that's it. But if you, for instance, say, okay, well, I actually have this application about 5 years ago, and I will need to add new features to it, so I need to get access to an older version of Perl, because I don't want to bother at this point of upgrading it, we will, for instance, provide that as an easy to set up and easy to use tool inside Fedora. So, of course, you say, I mean, all of these things are theoretically doable today, right? I mean, it's not like the system stops you from doing it, but we are going to make it easy. That's essentially
it. Right. It's kind of a spin almost that's bringing these pieces. So we're gonna start pulling this towards the finish line. One question I have is, Ack described this earlier on as Ubuntu kind of like walked through that fire bring in more focus around, like, essentially having a set of opinionated decisions about what Ubuntu should be, mm-hmm. and frankly saying that not everybody's opinions are going to be represented there. Now, when we went through that process, and I was very involved in that when that happened, there was a lot of, well, not a lot, but there was a number of key people at Red Hat and in the GNOME community who were hypercritical of us of doing that. Some of those individuals, I think, were borderline unprofessional in the way they shared their feedback. And what I fear, while I personally think what you're trying to do here is brilliant, it's exactly what you should be doing.
Yes.
It's making opinionated decisions, and that's not going to be good for everybody, but that's the nature of how you build software. But what I fear is that you're going to get caught up in that mangled mess in the same way that we did. What are your thoughts on how to prevent that from happening, or to at least protect yourself when you're going through that process?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer. I mean, I have been around in the Linux community for a long while, right? So I developed pretty thick right. skin in terms of dealing with with a lot of the natural yeah. online negativity that we all have to deal with on a regular basis. And I think, so I'm not easily discouraged. And I think that in some sense, that's the only way to do these kind of things, is that you have to set yourself a goal and then just sort of stay on it until you succeed.
Stick
and of course,
it.
It's a lot about reaching out to people and talking to them and trying to build a shared understanding of what we're trying to do. But of course, I mean, change in any community and system is difficult, right? Because anyone who is in a community today is there because, in some sense, what the community does today is exactly what they wanted to do. And if you're trying to change that, that, of course, is something that might not align with them. So,
right.
But, I mean, hopefully we'll find different ways, right, of letting people exist and prosper in the new system, too.
I just want to end by thanking you, Christian. In reading through your post, you made one statement that I just think it's very important that we quote here. And you said, and I quote, "If we look at the operating system as a collection of 100% independent parts, all developing at their own pace with their own agendas, we will never be able to create a truly great user experience on the desktop," which seems to clearly imply that Fedora has not to date provided a great user experience on the desktop, which I don't disagree with. And I've made that point many times myself, but I've always gotten in a lot of trouble for it. So I really appreciate someone at Fedora actually making that point for me. So thank you, Christian.
And the other thing as well is, I just want to wrap this up by Christian mentioned, you mentioned just now about you've got a bit of a thick skin. just to share a little story with our listeners, Christian helped me to get a thick skin because I remember, God, this was donkeys years ago when... Donkeys years again.
Yeah.
When I got the one of the first times I got like a bit of a nasty comment on my blog, and I was really beaten up by it. And I mentioned it to Christian, and Christian was like, "You must be delighted about that." And I was like, "What the hell is wrong with you? Why would I be happy about what that person wrote?" And he said, "Because it means that you're making a difference. It means that people care about what you're saying." And that resonated with me, and that stuck with me through my career. So I want to say a big thank you to you as well, Christian. So thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. And, nice being here.
Thank you, Christian.
And all the best for the future. I think it's great work that you're doing, and we wish you the best.
Okay, thank you. And keep up the good work for the show.
All right, guys, now I think it's time to continue the series that we've been doing on and off for the last few shows, and that is breaking down the bullshit. Now, in this episode, what we are going to attempt to break down meteorologist style is the cloud. So... I don't know what your guys' opinion on the bullshit level of the cloud is, but why don't we start with you, Eck?
One of the things that I think about the cloud is that it's a completely meaningless term at this point, but that's because you have to have an easily understandable term that everyone can go, oh yeah, I'm that thing, in order to get something adopted. The same thing happened with...
How is it meaningless? Isn't it pretty well understood that the cloud is basically software and services running like on like other machines out there?
It's the cloud.
I think that's what it started as, but I would agree with Eck, though. Now everything is just cloud-enabled, cloud-based.
Right? Was Hotmail, when it first released, the cloud? By your definition, yes. So,
no, I'm talking about...
Way to go, Hotmail.
Right? So it's not just software and services running on someone else's
freaking
machine.
Freaking pioneer.
Right? Because Gopher was a software and services running on someone else's machine in 1987, right? Well done. The cloud started a lot earlier than we thought.
Right. I mean, I would say that time sharing from the 50s is probably kind of, by some people's definition, the cloud.
Right.
Well, yeah.
I mean, if you ran a BBS in the 80s and 90s, that was the cloud. It was rad.
I agree that, like, if you want to, I mean, technically connecting to the internet is the cloud.
Yes,
right? I mean, right. If you want to stretch something beyond it being reasonably stretched, right, then I agree with you. But I think most people broadly understand what the cloud means.
No,
you know anything about technology.
I absolutely disagree with you. That's the point. Because you say, what does the cloud mean? And then you come up with a definition which includes connecting to the internet, Brian's BBS, and Gopher.
It's now, here's the thing, right? No one has those examples when they're talking about the definition of the cloud. Only you do. Muppetation.
That's what I said to you. Well, I mean,
and marketing departments far and wide.
Marketing departments include my BBS?
Yeah, absolutely. Your BBS, right? I said to you, John O'Bacon, define the cloud, and you come up with a definition of the cloud which includes Alexander Graham Bell. Therefore, it is not a good definition. Right? So, my point is...
Bullshit is strong in this one.
The reason I think the thing is bullshit is precisely because someone comes up with a term... it starts to get adoption. Everyone else then rebrands themselves as being that thing. We saw the same thing with HTML5, with Ajax, that sort of thing, right? With wearables. Everything that people now do is a wearable because it's the cool term. So the snowball effect means that everyone ends up redefining what they're doing to be this thing. And then it ends up meaningless.
By your logic, right, anything can be a wearable... so long as it could be conceivably stuck to a human being. You could say a car
with
is a wearable.
Duct tape, anything's wearable.
But here's the thing, right? Most people who are not insane don't think that, right? I mean, you know, like, I think you're stretching it a little too literally, in the same way that in the last show you said, why play Battlefield 4 when you can join the army, right? Are you seeing maybe some of the flaws in your logic?
You've been stewing on that for 2 weeks, haven't you?
I have been stewing on it, and I've been represented as a frickin' pony in the process of doing so. Okay.
Yeah, you have.
Right, so that's my opinion of the cloud. The phrase has now been diluted because everyone wants to call themselves cloud because it's cool, and it's therefore been diluted into meaninglessness. It's like, you know, marketing homeopathy. So, Brian's disagreeing with me. Imagine my surprise.
No.
So, go ahead, Brian. What do you think?
All right. I'll give you that the word cloud is an awfully simple word that describes something we all see in the sky every day to apply to such a broad range of technical topics. I'll give you that we probably should just have a new word for it. Like, I don't know.
Right.
Like,
fine. fine. You've given me that. Someone else is going to
or something. But wait. Here we go. Canonical, SUSE, Red Hat, Google, Amazon all define cloud in roughly the same way. They're all approaching it from the same standpoint, solving the same sets of problems. For taking, individual application instances and putting them into a distributed set of servers that are hosted somewhere else remotely. That's generally the thing, and there's sets of tools and whatnot that vary, but they all are kind of going for that same general thing. So for all of these mega companies, these companies that we work for or do business with every day, they're approaching the cloud from the same way. So I think it's a pretty consistent, simply defined thing at this point.
So We've talked quite a bit so far about how ACK is wrong, but more specifically, less about the term. Like, what about the technology, right? I mean, that's what we're really breaking down here. Like, I mean, I think we'd all agree there's been a huge amount of hype about the cloud, particularly 3 or 4 years ago, right? I mean, I think now it's a bit better defined because people understand what it is a little bit better now. Yeah. But do we think the actual technology is overhyped? Because I don't think it is. I think the cloud is one of those. To me, the cloud is the technology version of Justin Timberlake, right? It's something attractive that you feel like you should hate for lots of different reasons, right? He's good looking. He's great with the ladies. He's incredibly talented, right? Mm. He's basically better than me in every measurable possible way, right?
I should totally hate
that guy because of it. But I don't, because he's cool.
Like, he's super cool.
Like, he's actually really cool. And I think the same thing about the cloud. Like, I feel like I should dislike it because of all the hype, but it's actually changing the world, like, quite significantly. I mean, what do you guys think?
Yes.
Was I not clear enough a minute ago?
Wait, I want to hear what Jeremy thinks on this.
I would agree that some of the cloud paradigm, or whatever you want to call it, is definitely interesting and changing a little bit how we do things. But I think we did many of those things the same way before and just didn't call it the cloud, and it wasn't as fancy then.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just putting a name on something.
Whether it's bullshit or not, as much as I think Amazon and other companies are gravitating towards it, I think the next maybe 2 to 4 years, you're going to see some really, really bad things happen. It's going to make us take a different look at doing everything, quote unquote, in the cloud, whether it be privacy concerns or security concerns, ownership concerns. But even further than that, I mean, look at Amazon goes down for a little while and half the sites you use are unusable.
Yeah,
and I think when some of those companies reach that critical mass, I think if they were to have a catastrophic failure, you would see some huge companies probably end up going out of business or having humongous. And you're talking public companies here now, like Netflix. When Amazon's down, Netflix is in effect down. I think that we didn't really think well enough about what we're doing here and just kind of did it because it was easy and it's kind of the new shiny thing, you know, as you said. And I think, while it is something that is going to be with us for a while and in many ways should be with us, it's something that we need to maybe approach a little bit more carefully.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, I grant you, facetiousness is about gopher aside, right? Yes, the idea that cloud computing brought, that you can spin up machines, spin them down as many as you want easily, trivially through an API, that side of cloud deployment is a genuinely
awesome
new concept, and it is awesome.
Absolutely.
But the thing I find interesting is that the universe saw that a new thing had happened and responded by creating a new problem with it, specifically Edward Snowden. Because before there were ways of running your applications on someone else's computer, and yes, before there were concerns about privacy and things, but they weren't a big deal. And then cloud computing becomes a big deal where all your data's on someone else's servers half the time, you don't really know where it is. And at the same time, the privacy issues, which were the preserve of a very small group of people before, have suddenly become a really big problem because now Jono's tax data is all in Dropbox. All my passwords are in Gmail. They're on someone else's servers, and suddenly it's a problem.
First of all, I just want hackers to know my tax data is not in Dropbox, right? It's in a shoebox on my doorstep. But the second thing is, I think that I agree with Jeremy and I agree with you, Ak, that the growth in cloud computing, or more specifically distributed computing, has resulted in this new problem that we have, which is with privacy. But I don't think that's just to do with the cloud. I think that's just to do with the fact that there's just more stuff on the internet these days than there's ever been. More people are using social media, more people are putting their businesses online and all that. That's just like, that's just evolution of technology. But I agree with you, Jeremy, that there's going to be, I think there's going to be something, there's going to be a extinction-like event in the cloud that's going to make everybody question it at some point. I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be something like Heartbleed. It's going to be something that's going to fundamentally compromise everything. And I think that'll make people think differently. But then what that'll do is that the cloud won't go away. It'll just become more rigorous in some way.
I think you're all right on that point of view. But I think at the same time, you are all very, very much wrong. And here's the quick little synopsis of my thoughts on this.
Right.
We can't do without having information be distributed as we start doing things like, I don't know, let's say we want to go out into outer space and we need to be able to have cool little machines that communicate back with Earth, whatever. We are going to need to have more and increasing distributed information and communication. So the big key is not less cloud and not changing the paradigm, but having more things be open source and open standards, like what we see Red Hat, SUSE, and everyone else, well, most people doing at this point, so that we can continue to improve upon it, so we make sure that we can fix those sorts of security issues as they come up. So I'm not too terribly worried about it, but it is obviously going to be a problem. But since they're going to be open source, I don't see it as a big issue.
I would agree to that, but that kind of brings me to another kind of issue that I think we've probably all had, I'm guessing, at one point or another, is that if you, especially with software as a service, if you use some very cool software as a service, there is a very non-zero chance that either A, that business will fail, or B, they will change their idea of what a good business model is and the product you used will go away. And, you know, with open source and open standards, that does also get rid of that problem. But I think it's important to point out, I don't know how many people used Google Reader as a very small, trivial example. Really liked Google Reader.
It was nice.
And it going away was a big pain in the ass for me. And it's not like Google went away, but they just decided one day, Google Reader's not important to us anymore. Millions of you that used it, go find something else. And I think you're going to see a lot of that.
I wonder if we're going to see something in the same vein as the GPL that's going to be about protecting software in terms of where it's hosted.
Well, that already exists, right? It's the AGPL, Ethereal GPL.
No, but that's still in terms of the code. I'm talking about in terms of the provision of the service.
Oh, that's kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, I wonder if there's going to be something that basically says this, you know, this service is going to be protected through. Just a thing to chew on.
Okay.
In season 1, episode 13 of Bad Voltage, we covered the topic of wearables. One device that came up in that episode was the Pebble Watch. For those who are unfamiliar with the device, it's a first-generation smartwatch that has an e-paper display and an ARM Cortex M3 processor. It was originally funded by a Kickstarter, where the project hit over $10 million in funding based on a goal of just $100,000. I was one of the initial backers who got the Jet Black Pebble for just $99. With its fairly low price point, the watch is admittedly pretty basic from an aesthetics perspective. The rubber watch band, for example, is certainly not my favorite. The watch face itself, while plastic, is sleek and well constructed, and the e-paper display is actually quite usable. The battery lasts for a little under a week depending on usage, and the device is even water resistant, meaning it can be fully submerged in water or worn while running in the rain. It connects to iPhone and Android smartphones using Bluetooth and can alert you with a silent vibration or an on-screen notification to incoming calls, emails, text messages, weather alerts, sports scores, calendar events, and more. You can also select from a wide variety of watch faces. Some of the watch faces are extremely well done, and while this is simple functionality, it's one of my favorite aspects of the watch. From a customization perspective, that's really just the beginning though, as the watch can also be loaded with apps. Cyclists can use the Pebble as a bike computer, accessing the GPS on their smartphone to display speed, distance, and pace data. You can use the music control app to play, pause, or skip tracks on your phone with the touch of a button on the watch. You can use the device to control your GoPro camera or Nest thermostat, and there's even a free Caddy app that works as a golf rangefinder. The Pebble can receive simple alerts and notifications from If This Then That or via a web-facing RESTful endpoint. there's also a C-based SDK. Basically, you can send anything that would have been a push notification directly to the device, and then the device can send data from its accelerometer and buttons back up to the internet. The app ecosystem is fairly new, but some interesting third-party apps are already starting to appear, with services like Pandora, Runkeeper, Foursquare, and Yelp jumping into the fray. For those who didn't like the look or construction of the original Pebble, which is still available with an MSRP of $150, the next generation Pebble, the Pebble Steel, is already available. As the name indicates, the new device is made of brushed or matte stainless steel and comes with either a leather or metal band, which I would consider a big improvement. The watch face itself is both larger and higher quality and now comes with Gorilla Glass and a notification LED. Overall, the new Pebble Steel looks significantly nicer, but it does so at a higher cost of $250. So, what's the bad voltage verdict? At $99, I have to say I'm pleased with the device. To be fair, the new App Store has certainly had some hiccups, and some of the apps are either a bit buggy or sound more useful than they actually end up being. The largest disappointment from my perspective is probably that you can only have 8 watch faces or apps on the device at any given time, and that's not nearly enough. But for a first generation device that costs less than $100, I think it was a bargain. The new Pebble Steel looks to be a nice iteration, but whether it's worth $250 is likely a matter of personal preference, so I'll leave that decision to the bad voltage listener.
So Jeremy, it seems like overall you're pretty happy with it, right?
Yeah, I would say, like I said, especially the fact that I got it for, you know, under $100, I think it is a pretty cool little device. I will say, you know, out in public, especially when I just got it, it did get a lot of people asking questions about it and thought it was pretty neat. I will say now that a lot of apps and watch faces are out, and I said this in the review, the 8 limit, and that includes both apps and watch faces, is borderline absurd. But other than that, that's a pretty cool little device.
That, I didn't understand that, because, I mean, having gone and looked this up, right, a micro SD card is the size of the little windy wheel on the side of my watch, and you can now buy 128 gig micro SD cards, right? And as far as I can tell, a watch face for the Pebble is basically a black and white 178 pixel square GIF. Right? Why can you only fit 8 of them on the
like,
wall?
That's like the resolution of a Game Boy, man. Those things are big.
Yeah, as far as design decisions go, this is one of the more nonsensical ones from every aspect I could tell.
Is it different with the steel?
I don't have a steel, so I don't know. I would hope so.
It's kind of cool looking,
I just don't understand what kind of apps. I know you used a few examples like, you know, controlling the GoPro camera and the Nest, that kind of stuff. But I don't understand what I'm going to want to control with my watch that I can't do better with my smartphone where the screen's bigger. Like, it seems like the only thing I want with my watch is going to be like maybe information being transmitted to my wrist, which is interesting, such as text messages, I guess. That's really about it.
There are a few things you could imagine. I mean, very simple examples of the thing are things like skipping to the next track while you're jogging or whatever.
The GoPro, because it is waterproof, if you're doing something with the GoPro, which is also waterproof, in the water, I don't know that you want to be tearing around with your smartphone.
Hang on, I don't know what you mentioned a GoPro camera, which I assume was just a camera. I didn't understand why you want to control it with your watch. It's waterproof. What is it?
So it's the like GoPro a is a camera. Kind of a very nice, indestructible camera. So you can, drop it at 100 miles an hour, throw it in the air. It can go underwater. It can do pretty much anything.
People use it for like extreme
and stuff like that.
I was going to say,
what you could do is just have a regular camera and not drop it, right? But people
it comes
use
with
it
like mounts and stuff, so you can put it on a motorcycle, you can put it on a snowmobile, boat.
For limited things like that, essentially using it as a 4-button remote control, you never have to take as a universal remote control. I can see that definitely. And as Jonah says, I can see having, incoming Google Plus notifications appear on my watch be slightly more convenient than having to take my phone out of my pocket. But more complicated things, I'm still not sold on the idea that having a watch with a battery life of 2 days is a useful trade-off to get this stuff.
I will say that the apps to me aren't overly compelling. I really think some of the watch faces and be able to have a bunch of different, vastly different watch faces is, to me, the more compelling part, which is probably not what they had in mind. But I think the Steel is a nice enough looking watch that, and I will go on the record as saying I'm someone who really likes watches, so maybe if you're not into watches or only owned one watch, this might not be something interesting.
No,
this
could you not just buy 12 watches for $8 a piece?
Yeah, you see, people into watches act, don't pay $8 for a watch.
Right.
I have one good watch that I'm happy with. Right?
Now,
being able to change the color of the face is not the same thing as having a new watch.
It would seem to me, Act, that they made an opinionated decision and you're outside of their market.
Right, so it's basically a modern day Swatch watch, is what I think.
Realistically, I think Stuart, I think you completely missed the point. I don't think that this watch at all needs to have a valid use case scenario. I don't think we need to be able to say this watch is going to be able to be better at reading your email than your phone or something like that. It's a badass watch that you can freaking program. This is like Get Smart James Bond awesome stuff that you can play with.
Get Smart. All it can do is things that lame game and watches could do 30 years ago. If it had a laser beam in it, I'd be all over it.
Did you just call game and watches lame? I'm done talking to you.
Yes, I did.
We're done. That's it. This is the last episode of Bad
Brian World. Throws down the mic. Watch.
Let me ask you, Jeremy, what I think is the key question, I think, that's more important than anything, right? So you got this watch. Think about the way you were beforehand. Before you had it, and the way you are right now, do you feel like that watch has brought enough value to your life, and at least $100 worth of value to your life? Like, outside of the fact that it's a cool little gadget and, you know, it's a bit of a novelty, like, is it worth it? Like, I think that's what most of our listeners want to know.
I would say for me personally, because I happen to like gadgets like that, it has provided me probably $100 worth of utility. Yes, that's a pretty low bar to me. I don't know that I can think of any $100 device I own that has literally changed the quality of my life. That's a pretty high bar.
Jeremy, ivory back scratcher.
Continuing that question slightly, do you actually use it on a regular basis? I don't mean you consciously make an effort to use it. And I'm aware you have it on, but I have a watch on. Do you use the things that make it a pebble instinctively now without thinking about it? Or do you have to make a conscious effort to think, oh, I must choose to do this with my watch because I bought a pebble and that's what it's for?
So I'm going to answer two questions. I think the most important question you're really going to ask and that Jono was asking is, would I spend $100 on it again?
Right.
Knowing what it is. And I absolutely would buy it again at $100, yes, with no equivocations. I do regularly wear it. And I have, like I said, I really do like watches. I have a few of them. And I regularly wear this one because of that. And I do find myself regularly looking at to see if there's any cool new watch faces out. I will say, honestly, before I did the review, I had never downloaded an app before. The App Store is so terrible and so buggy that I tried it once. Didn't think they were interesting. I downloaded the ESPN app, and it is cool, so I can say I like the Bills and I like the Sabres, and if one of them score, it'll show it on the watch, which I already have that on my smartphone. I guess it's mildly more convenient. I think the apps, maybe once you get to the second or third generation device, when it's a little better, maybe it has a touchscreen, maybe the apps will be compelling then. I don't know that they are now, but I do regularly wear the watch, yes.
But
when you say cool new watch faces, you're talking about cool new monochrome watch faces, right?
This one, because it's e-paper, because the battery does last longer than 2 days. If it had a color display, I don't think it would. There's an actual app that you can use as a viewfinder for your smartphone camera, and it's in monochrome e-paper.
Sounds ridiculous.
That's awesome.
Does it have a little thing in the corner saying FPS 1?
It looks like it was done in an Etch-a-Sketch. I mean, it is. Awesome. I wouldn't recommend it for that quite yet. But
Jeremy, what you're saying is, it's not particularly that it's a smart watch that you think it's worth it. It's just that it's a watch with changeable pictures on it, and that in itself is cool enough.
Yes.
Excellent. Oh, that's cool. A good recommendation. I never saw the point of the smartness of it because it seems rubbish. I'm sure generation 2 and 3 and 4 will be better. But just having a watch where I can change the picture on it itself seems like it'd be worth $100 to me.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Correct.
Yes. Cool tool.
All right, here we are for another community recap. This is the part of the show where we talk about the stuff that's going on in the community. Before we get started, I just want to clarify, you can go to community.badvoltage.org, which is our bustling forum. Lots of great discussion happening there. But you can also go to the IRC channel, which is #badvoltage, which you can also get to via badvoltage.org/IRC for real-time chat. So,
is that what it stands for? It stands for the real-time chat? Very nice.
Real time.
Isn't it relay chat? Real anyway.
Time. Relay. It's internet relay.
No, it is relay. I was saying it's real time chat. I wasn't saying IRC is internet real time.
Well, we would be offended if you didn't start it off, John. Oh, go ahead. Wow.
Does IRC actually stand for it's real time chat?
It's real time chat.
It's kind of like when you walk into a room, throw a light switch, and you get IOL lighting. You get the instant on lighting. That's the same kind of thing. Hey, guys. All right. So last week, John, you did a test, like a test run for our listening party, right? That was awesome. How'd that go? Did that work? Did it explode?
Yeah. So basically badvoltage.org/party, I mentioned this like the day before and said, like, come along to this party. And basically what we do is we're going to stream the latest show live as an Icecast stream, and you can just connect with your browser, you know, Firefox, Chromium, Chrome, fine. Like, you can't use IE and Safari, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
And then basically there's an embedded chat channel and it's internet relay chat channel, as well as a tweet stream. And then basically the show streams and people can listen to it as it's streaming and everybody can talk as they listen to the show.
Hang on. So the idea is that a bunch of people get together virtually, like, and listen to the show all at the same time.
Cool. You know, when we're at, like, I don't know, if we're talking about Brendan Eich, at that point when you're listening to it, everybody else is listening to the same sections. So it's just an interesting way for people to have a conversation and listen to the show together instead of individually.
And it's a great opportunity to trial run for a drinking game. I'm thinking that we could get a couple of drinking games going, like, anytime Stuart says something wrong, everyone takes a shot. Something along those lines. And then you get to get drunk.
Isn't it at 10 a.m. where you are? You'll be belligerently drunk before noon.
Yeah, it depends where you are, I guess, right? I mean, for me, it's like 11 o'clock in the morning. So,
hey, come on.
So, yeah, good
only
idea.
Hardcore people here.
You'll be fine.
So we had about 20 people show up to that, which I was pretty happy with, given the fact that we had, you know, not that much notice. And it was really more of a test of Icecast and whether it was going to serve that many people. And it worked pretty flawlessly. Everyone was pretty happy and had a bit of fun, and the streams worked well. So every time we release a show on a Thursday every 2 weeks, there will be a listening party at 6 p.m. UTC. That's 7 p.m. UK. That's 8 p.m. in Europe. And that's 11 a.m. in Pacific and 2 p.m. Eastern, right? So you can go to badvoltage.org/party and you can click the date of the next party and it'll give all the conversions for you. Yeah, every day, every time we release a show, go there and listen to it with everybody else, have a bit of fun. So, yeah,
that's basically nice. One other thing, Jono, I understand you've been communitizing the community with community tools, specifically SurveyMonkey.
Yeah, the other thing, yeah, good point. So, we threw out a survey just to ask people what they think about the show, and in the survey, we basically, I'm not going to go through everything in detail because it'll be here forever, but basically we asked, you know, how often do you listen to the show? How do you get it? What are the most interesting segments? What kind of topics are interesting to you? You know, and just overall, like, what do you think of it? And we had a lot of responses and just overwhelmingly positive. I mean, there's stuff in here that we were surprised by. For example, most people listen to the show via podcasting software. We assume that most people press the play now buttons on the website. So there's little things like that, but overwhelmingly positive that people are enjoying the show. There was some great constructive criticism of things that we can improve. A few people mentioned, like, some audio production bits and pieces, for example, with interviews, you know, that kind of stuff. But overwhelmingly, people love the show. There was a feedback about what segments most people find interesting. Like, we weren't sure whether people really like the reviews and the interviews. And generally, people really do like the reviews and the interviews. They feel like it breaks it up. People, by and large, really enjoy open source and technology-related discussion. Less interested in sports and fitness, it turns out.
No sports.
So, thank you to everybody who filled that in. It's really... it's really going to help us kind of carve the show out to be the best that it can be. And it was, if nothing else, it was just kind of a bit invigorating for us to kind of go through and read it and figure out that, yeah, I think we're on the right track. So
absolutely.
Yep. Something I wanted to chip in with, countering the fact that we're doing a really good job. Apparently, we're all doing a really good job, apart from Jono, who knows nothing about games. There's a thread on the forum called Enemy Territory, or Jono Talks Enormous Amounts of Shit, which is Jono's Battlefield 4 review, where Mr. Ben takes issue with your description of the game, your analysis of its gameplay style, your knowledge of the gaming industry, and for all I can tell, your haircut and your friends as well. But he says here, Battlefield 4 is almost definitely a wonderful game. It probably has many cool features, but to suggest that it is in any way unique in its gameplay style is bullshit on a Tory party political broadcast scale. Our own John O'Bacon then responds saying, well, no. I didn't say that no other game has team-based objectives. I said, to my knowledge, no other game has this. At which point, Neuro then followed up saying, well, you missed out Battlefield 1942, World War II Online, Outrigger, Team Fortress, Ghost Recon, Unreal Tournament, Time Splitters, Star Trek Voyager Elite Force, and GoldenEye 007 on the Nintendo 64. So, it's an almost unique experience in my entire life. We got Jono to admit that he was wrong on this particular point.
That was nice.
God, he actually says here, Community 1 Jono Naught, which has ruined my brilliant new monitor, because as soon as I saw it, I drew a big red ring around it so I wouldn't forget that I'd seen it.
By the way, like, just the pure, like, bubbling hypocrisy that is flowing right now.
I do not know what you mean. But one of the things, the reason I wanted to mention this, that, well, apart from giving John a kick in the ghoulies because it's amusing, is that it's really useful when we get this kind of feedback, you know, when people listen to the show and then say, no, hang on, I don't think you were right about that, and here is why. And then we get into a decent discussion about it. So this stuff tends to go on beyond the end of the show, which I really like.
On a related point, one of the points in the survey was like a bunch of people talked about like they like the show and whatever else. And a lot of people said, in terms of the community, like specifically the forum and the IRC channel, a lot of people said it doesn't apply to them, that they haven't really used it.
It applies to all of you.
Right, exactly. We know from past experience, it takes a while to build a podcast up and get people joining the forum, whatever else. But like, seriously, go and tell your friends, go and tell other people who aren't necessarily on the phone, because it's a lot of fun and we have a really nice group there and we want to see that change. We want to get more people discussing the show and the topics in the show and what they think about the show as we move forward. Speaking of which, Jeremy.
I was going to say, speaking of which, you guys all got to prove Jono wrong on the Battlefield 4, and now is your chance to prove Ak wrong. Previous to the show, Own Cloud had kind of come up internally between the group here. I have personally never used it. Ak took about a minute just straight taking the piss out of it, where Brian actually seemed to have had a positive experience with it. So I'm kind of curious to you and the community, if you have used Own Cloud or any of the other open source cloud tools, be it Eucalyptus or whatever, we'd appreciate it if you'd start a thread and let us know what you thought of Own Cloud or Eucalyptus, any of them, if whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether Ak has no idea what he's talking about. Or how correct Brian may have been.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we could find the other satisfied Own Cloud customer.
So hang on a second. There are only two options are Brian's right or Ak's wrong.
Yeah, yeah. That's particular
case. No thread gets created.
Yeah. There's no gray area.
Badvoltage.org/party. Go and check out the listening party when we release the show. And go to community.badvoltage.org and have fun.
So that's show 14 over. I think we should point out, as I think a service to the community and to the wider people at large, is that vilified doesn't mean wrong, John.
Shut up, by the way. Can I ask a favour, Jeremy? This just jumped into my head.
I cannot wait for this one. I'm a little nervous to say yes, but go ahead.
Okay, so a while back, we were at OSCOM. Last year, I think it was, and we were stood. The beer had just opened up, and we were in the expo area. And when we were there, you told me a story about a mascot and a golf cart. And it amused me quite significantly, and I think you should share that story with our listeners.
That is a fairly long story, although it is quite amusing. I'll try to break it down to a short. This will be the longest outro ever, by the way.
Right, but I just figured like this is a good way to go out, get a show out.
All right, absolutely. I don't think Brian or X heard this one either, so it'll be a first time for them as well as the community.
This is freaking hilarious.
Lay it on me.
So I knew someone who was a mascot for a team that will remain unnamed, and as he was actually the backup mascot, so we got to do like events and stuff that the main person didn't want to do. And
backup mascot.
He was, of course, not allowed to take the head off.
On your business card, wouldn't you? It's
a ringing endorsement.
Not the mascot, backup mascot.
Backup mascot. So he wasn't allowed to take his head off for fear of terrifying little children or whatever. So he was out on a hot day at an event and was itching and sweating in this thing and waiting to just get back to a place where he could take the suit off and relax a little bit. And so at the end, it's a pretty bulky suit, so they have a guy driving around in a golf cart. And he hops into the golf cart at the end. It's an older gentleman, he said. He's like, I just couldn't wait to get out of here. And the guy takes off like a shot. And at first, he's like, oh, this is actually good. You know, we're going to get out of here quick. And it's like, the guy is driving like an absolute maniac. And at one point, he almost hit somebody, and he's driving around. They were near a golf course. He actually went through one of the holes and everything. And at this point, he's getting nervous. And he said, you could scream in this thing, and you just will be screaming into the huge head. Like, no one can actually hear what you're saying. So he's like, I can't even really yell at the guy, and now I'm actually debating taking this head off. But he doesn't. Until the guy almost dumps the cart and they run into one of the charity tents, in which case he's like, you know what, they could fire me, whatever. Takes the head off to yell at the guy, and there's no one in the cart next to him. His big fat mascot foot just had hit the gas. He looked back, the guy was chasing him. No one was driving the cart. So he was just driving around, no one driving like an idiot.
That's awesome.
Oh, goodness.
I just have this vision of this mascot on the side of a golf cart just flying up into the distance.
40 miles over people throwing themselves out of the way.
It was years ago now. I wish it was more recently because I'm sure it would be on YouTube and stuff, but it was long enough ago that everyone's camera was not also a phone, unfortunately.
Thanks for that, Jeremy.
I nearly burst from laughing when you told me that story. I figured our listeners should hear it. All right.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Wait. One other thing. This weekend, if you guys are in the Pacific Northwest of North America, I'm going to be up at Linux Fest Northwest. So that's whatever it is. Is that the 26th and 27th? Something like that. So if you guys want to come by and, you know, free high fives are be given out, I'll be up there doing my little dog and pony show, being a dancing monkey, and it'll be lots of fun. So
are
if you guys
doing
are
your Linux does not suck thing?
Yeah, doing the yearly Linux sucks, Linux doesn't suck thing, and it should be a blast. It's always a lot of fun when people come out.
Are you going to be wearing your Bad Voltage t-shirt?
I don't have a Bad Voltage t-shirt.
Oh, Jono's got a Bad Voltage t-shirt.
Yeah.
Yes, and, Jono does.
Yeah, but didn't Jono wash it and then it went to hell or something like that?
I will say, I don't know if he has some kind of crazy industrial West Coast washing machine. I washed mine and it was fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine. I got a low quality product.
Yeah, no Bad Voltage t-shirt. I'll be going incognito. So I might be a little hard to find, but I'll be there.
Right. Just look for the hipster glasses and listen out for bullshit and you'll find it. All right. So thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us for another fun show. Remember, community.badvoltage.org is where you can find the rest of the community. And see you next time.
Bye-bye.